It's time now for America in the Balance. Brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Amanda Teagarden and Don Wyatt.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is your host, Amanda Teagarden, in studio with my co-host, Don Wyatt.
Happy to be here, and I like my dad used to say, I'm happy to be anywhere today.
You've had a few close calls lately. We're glad you're here, too.
Well, we've both been battling various kinds of health issues, and I'm glad to see us both at least on our feet.
I'm getting over a cold, and Don has had a series of other more serious things happening, so we're very fortunate, and we thank the Lord that you're back again. Our website is ok-safe.com. That's Oklahoma, ok-safe.com, ok-safe. We have a new website called Exposing Healthcare Reform, the truth about healthcare reform in Oklahoma. And that web address is exposinghealthcarereform.com. Spell all the words correctly. Don has a website called Boondoggle Blog. And would you give the listeners the URL?
Yeah, it's really easy. It's boondoggleblog.com. And boondoggle is just like it sounds and just like you think of a useless work being paid for with public money. That's what boondoggle means. And it's boondoggleblog.com.
All spelled correctly. You'll have a lot of content for that website if that's the subject.
It's accumulating. In fact, if I could keep up with it, it would be accumulating without limit, I think. We've got a number of Senator Coburn's materials posted out there. So if any of our listeners hear these stories about Senator Coburn from Oklahoma publishing various reports and books about waste in the federal government, most of those can be found easily on Boondoggle Blog if you want to go look at it there.
On exposinghealthcarereform.com, that's OK Safe's single subject website. It's still under development, but there is a lot of material that's already available. And we encourage people, if you're listening from Oklahoma, to go there and check the Oklahoma timeline. And it shows how we've been progressively implementing healthcare reform in this state. And it started long before the election of the president in 2008.
Sure did.
And it's not what you think it is. It's more about the IT connections to make everything work, but you're not going to hear that from your elected officials. We're very fortunate today to have as our guest Benjamin Domenech, who is from the Heartland Institute. And Don, you were able to go to Oklahoma City. Did you hear him in Oklahoma City?
I did not make it for that. I'm sorry. I didn't get
Everyone
there.
Who has gone to Oklahoma heard those presentations, and there were three over a series of days in Oklahoma City recently.
That's right.
This broadcast is being recorded in February. He was guest of Representative Charles Key, right, and spoke to both the Senate and the House members and to an organization called OPAC in Oklahoma City,
right,
to an audience, and was well received by all of them, talking about the Heartland Institute's position on whether the states should establish a state-based health insurance exchange.
Exactly.
Their position is similar to what Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute said, right, last fall on this show, is that the states would be in a better position to not establish a state-based exchange and would be further ahead economically, but also politically, yeah, if they would not do that.
Almost a tactical perspective on it as opposed to a strategic, whereas OK Safe's argument is that we don't want these rights and liberties compromised. So it's a little bit more of a strategic argument, but same conclusion.
Our conclusion is based on the fact that whether the state builds the exchange or the federal government does, because of the groundwork that's been laid,
exactly,
as outlined on exposinghealthcarereform.com, there would be virtually no difference,
right,
between the functions of a state-based exchange and that of a federal.
Exactly.
So today's guest is going to be talking about that very subject. And what we're talking about is all across the United States, states are engaged in efforts to resist the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which the public calls Obamacare. Really, I think that was a strategic name because it really didn't start with him.
That's right, it did not.
Anyway, including
he'll take credit for it, though.
He'll take credit, yeah, or blame. including not establishing the controversial health insurance exchanges. OKSAFE has taken that position, opposing the implementation of a state-based insurance exchange. And today's guest, Ben Dominich, and he's going to correct my pronunciation, I'm sure, is from the Heartland Institute, which has taken the same stance, saying it would be better for states to not implement a state-based exchange. If you're interested in checking out the Heartland Institute, you can go to heartland.org. And I'm going to bring up our guest right now. Benjamin, are you there?
I am. Thanks so much for having me, Amanda.
Well, thank you very much for being our guest today. And before we get started, I want to read a paragraph from a policy brief issued by the Heartland Institute. And this is dated April 2011. And it says, this policy brief explains that the middle path is treacherous, where some states are considering a blend of the two. It offers no protection against future decisions by the federal bureaucracy, collaborates with an unconstitutional framework, and risks undercutting court cases across the country. Those similar arguments that we laid out.
Right.
This brief concludes that in formulating their response to the exchange requirement, state officials should reject false offers of flexibility, recognize the weakness of federal threats, and responsibly refused to implement Obama's law. So, Benjamin, for our listeners who are not familiar with the Heartland Institute, please tell us about yourself and what the Heartland Institute does.
Sure. Heartland is a 28-year-old think tank based out of Chicago. It primarily concentrates, I would say, on advancing arguments for free market principles and for consumer power. In a variety of areas, we have a number of issue suites that people will be able to see if they go to our website, and covers all sorts of areas when it comes to budget and tax policy, environmental policy, education policy, and all sorts of other areas. We work primarily focused on the states, and in terms of Heartland's history, we've been primarily functional in sort of pushing for education reforms, holding the line against encroaching regulation on the environmental front, and pushing for obviously more responsible budgetary approaches for tax cuts and pushing back against tax hikes. Within the healthcare space, and I have been with Heartland now for about 2.5 years, we have been more and more focused on the fight, the long and I would say arduous fight to devolve power back from central government in Washington to the states. What we found is essentially that over the course of many decades, I would say, you know, even before Lyndon Johnson, but certainly he was one of the most significant elements of this, the control over health policy in this country has been taken away from the states, which historically had that responsibility and ability to direct their own path, and just taken over essentially by the federal government. And we believe that that should not be the case. We think that states should have the rights to pursue all sorts of various solutions as their populace demands and as they see fit. As they see fit, we would argue within that that the solutions we pursue ought to be ones that give people more transparency, more power within a marketplace to make their own determinations of the kind of care they receive, the kind of insurance they purchase, the kind of products they buy. But we also believe, essentially, that states should have the right to fail. They should have the right to make the wrong decision. And so if a state like Massachusetts wants to pursue the model that they have, you know, that's something that we would obviously argue against and encourage them not to do. But we really believe that states ought to be the one that direct their own path on this. And the upshot of that is that you have a competitive environment where if the legislators of Oklahoma were to make the good decisions, the right decisions, to make for more transparency of care, to make for less centralization, make for more market forces that people can use to make decisions as they see fit, then they could reap the benefits of that in terms of companies and individuals moving to their state in order to enjoy the benefits of free enterprise, and moving away from states like Massachusetts or Vermont or California that might make wrong decisions. That's something that we've argued for years, and I would say that we have shifted that argument a little bit in response to the reforms of the more recent years, both the Medicare Part D entitlement and then in the wake of, obviously, President Obama's health care law. Our fight now is very much focused on stopping states from doing anything to implement what we believe is not just an unconstitutional and an unprincipled law, but one that would have enormous negative pragmatic effects regardless of what your ideology is, on the people who are affected by it.
What was your position on the Medicare Part D program?
My own opposition, personally, and I have to confess that I went from working within the federal government at HHS to working in the Senate for Senator Cornyn, who initially voted against it and then finally voted for it. I disagreed with that decision. My opposition was more born out of the fact that I felt that an entitlement of that nature that was not paid for and that did not have an actual long-term fiscal sanity behind it was not something that the United States ought to be doing. I also don't think constitutionally that it's something that falls within the prerogative of the federal government to do. And so from my perspective, that's something that, again, should be devolved back to the states. In terms of the lessons of Medicare Part B, many of the solutions that Republicans are currently proposing within Washington build upon some of the more positive aspects of it, namely that people within a marketplace making decisions are always going to be better than a government bureaucrat dictating where they ought to go. I think that that's something that's positive that's come out of it. However, it does make me concerned when you see some of the decisions that are being made on the part of leading Republicans today to invest so much faith in what is still essentially a government-run and regulated institution when you look right down at it. And that's the kind of thing that we time and again see, that frankly, marketplaces that people run, where they have the ability to make decisions within a transparent environment, they're always going to come up with a better solution than ones that are centralized in Washington and that are dictated by bureaucrats.
Has it been your observation as you watch the bureaucracies at work that once they are established, they never turn back? They never recognize or admit to mistake. They just keep plowing ahead, whichever path they're on. And as a result, there's no self-correction in their strategic approaches to things.
You're completely accurate in that statement. And what I would add is, you know, obviously it was Ronald Reagan, I believe, who said that, you know, the closest thing to eternal life on earth is a government agency.
Exactly.
I think that when it comes down to it, the thing you need to understand about bureaucrats, many of whom are I would say, perfectly normal, well-meaning individuals, they really do have faith in their own ability to manage your life better than you can for yourself. And because of that, they are in a sort of what I would describe as kind of tyrannical do-gooders, in the sense that they believe that what they are doing is the best for you, the best for society, maybe not specifically for you. And because of that, they are completely willing to exercise every lever that they have put in front of them. And not just that, but to essentially to get into an extended number of turf battles in order to expand their own reach, their own power, and also to make themselves incapable of being cut in the future. One of the ways that you see that happen again and again is sort of ways where agencies will look for a new thing to regulate or to manage or a new problem to highlight. They reach out to their friends in the media to highlight that problem, and then they are given more money from Congress, which obviously is happy to dole out money for things or has been historically, and it allows them to not just expand their reach but to make themselves more permanent. And then eventually you have agencies that have become so permanent that they have all sorts of jobs attached to them. They have interested parties who have worked for many years and spent millions of dollars on lobbyists in order to gain access to them, and then it's impossible to get rid of them. We've seen that expansion happen in just one of the more prominent examples within the Food and Drug Administration, which
sure
continues
have.
Today to overreach from its original mission. It has gone well beyond protecting the American people from drugs that could cause them harm,
right,
and has reached the point where it holds back on innovative treatments and makes it impossible for Americans, even if the drugs are being made and sold and given to folks in Europe, to gain access to those things in the American marketplace, which from our perspective is a travesty.
The scenario you were just describing about bureaucracies creating more jobs for themselves to becoming more indispensable and finding a problem that they need to solve, and then, of course, they get awarded the new job. A new job is created at their agency is the very thing that's happening here in Oklahoma with the suggestion of adding 5 more program integrity auditors to the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority so that they could find more Medicaid fraud, which, of course, that was a problem because we added more people to Medicaid, so there's more fraud. So now we need more program integrity auditors. But no worries, there's a federal matching, dollar-for-dollar match.
And that's free money. So.
And the people will make $80,000 a year, but $40,000 of it comes from the federal government. And I was having that discussion today with the author of the bill who believes that it will save the state some money. I said, but what are you going to do? Now you're on the hook for more people for a bureaucracy that's already bloated. The argument I was putting forth was if they are so overwhelmed, is reduce their responsibilities, let them be the manageable size, and then you add more as they've proven to be good stewards of their responsibility instead of continuing to add more. But we're not going in that direction.
Hey, Ben, you said something a minute ago that I, back when I was a political science major in college, did some studies and proved to myself was true, and that is that the first and primary duty or job of a bureaucrat is to defend his own job. And his secondary duty is to justify at least one or two more jobs. And I, when I worked for civil service for a year and a half, I was astonished at how much time, energy, and creativity was invested in making sure that all of the jobs there remained and that they got a few more opened up. And that was really what the mission was.
The Heritage Foundation did a study last year, in fact, that found that in a vast number of federal agencies, the likeliest way to lose your job was actually to die as opposed to being fired. You were more likely to pass away from old age than you were to actually be fired. And so the thing that I think is important to keep in mind about the various agencies and things that people see being set up, either at the state level or at the federal level, because this is the nature of government, let's be honest.
Exactly.
Once those things are set up, they are more than likely to never go away. They will expand. And, you know, the fact is that most of these slippery slope arguments turn out to be true. And even if people deny them at the time and say, oh, that'll never happen, you know, under future administrations, under future legislators, under people who are looking for something to do, to meddle or to, you know, again, they can be motivated by thinking that they're looking for the best outcome for you. But the upshot of it is creating more government jobs, creating more of a redistribution of your tax dollars from you to the state. And that's something that I think that, you know, not just within the healthcare space, but in all areas, that we believe has a very negative effect, not just on marketplaces, but on the people who are taxed.
We're talking about health insurance exchanges, and some in our audience may not actually understand and what is a health insurance exchange. So could you please define the health insurance exchange concept as it's outlined in the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. And let me first start off by saying that, you know, the exchange, you know, from the perspective of the authors of the Affordable Care Act is sold as something that's very positive. It's sold as essentially a state-level marketplace for the purchase of insurance. And that can all sound well and good, and they talk a lot about, oh, it's going to be like Orbitz or Expedia or Travelocity. You know, you're going to be able to get online and pick between plans. The truth is that the free market has actually already developed this within the individual market. You can go to ehealthinsurance.com or any of these other outlets that are out there that allow you to compare plans and then connect with an agent and purchase a plan. What they essentially want to do is throw that model out into the public and have them purchase things. What they don't tell you is that what these really are is not actually a marketplace or anything that resembles a state-run marketplace. It's much more a delivery mechanism for the encroaching regulations of Washington into the state level with plausible deniability for the consequences of it. And as such, you know, this is a delivery mechanism not just for the regulations that they pass out of HHS, but also for price controls, for their ability to clamp down on insurers by simply telling them they cannot charge an amount for a product that they sell, and for costly taxpayer-funded subsidies, which at the last count was underestimated in the cost of Obama's law by about $50 billion a year. The thing that is you need to keep in mind about these exchanges is that they have been tried to a certain degree in Massachusetts and in Utah. Utah's exchange is very small. It's targeted only for small businesses and was essentially a test project. It did not have taxpayer-funded subsidies within it, so that means that the expense of running it was far lower. And it was just designed to be something that met the needs of employers in the states. We are not, at Heartland, opposed to a model along those lines. If states think that it's functional, if it's needed or if it's functional. The problem that we have, though, is that setting up those exchanges usually means to regulators taking over how that's going to be managed and determining what coverage is allowed to be sold within an exchange, who can buy what, when they can buy, et cetera, et cetera. And we think that that's something that's an encroachment. We don't like that idea. We would prefer to see private entities set up exchanges themselves. Frankly, this is another area where the marketplace has the best instincts. But in Massachusetts, we've seen the consequences of essentially the very same program at the state level. That's an individual mandate, plus taxpayer-funded subsidies, plus a Medicaid expansion, plus price controls. And the results of it have not just been budget-busting in terms of Massachusetts budget. That's something that you're actually helping pay for when you pay your federal taxes, because Massachusetts takes a huge chunk of the support for this project from their Medicaid dollars, which are from the federal government. So, congratulations, you've helped fund that. In terms of what President Obama did at the national level, his interest was in forcing every state to form an exchange along these lines, where you would be mandated to purchase coverage through it. You would be mandated to, there would be all sorts of mandates that would be directed to the insurers on what they would cover, what they would pay for, what they would have to cover in order to function through the exchanges. And the upshot of all of this is getting you in a marketplace that the government can manage and see and do what it sees fit. In terms of the ramifications of this for states, many states looked at this initially and thought, well, you know, this is a law, and even if we oppose it, you know, we feel like we have to implement it. But places like Cato and Heartland and several other think tanks and individuals have spoken out against that idea with a great degree of success. The fact is that at the moment there are only 15 states that have actively pursued and passed laws to implement an exchange. The vast majority of them are in sort of a gray area. And then there's another pocket of them that have not just rejected an exchange, but actually sent back the carrot that the federal government offered in terms of a taxpayer-funded grant worth millions of dollars, and that obviously includes Oklahoma. In terms of what that means, these states are essentially arguing, we're not going to set up an exchange because we've realized it means that we're going to essentially be the arbiters for you, for the federal government at the state level, and we're really not going to have much say in how this is implemented. That's one of the reasons why governors who really understand healthcare policy, such as Bobby Jindal, who obviously worked at HHS, such as Rick Scott, who has his entire career within the healthcare space, in Louisiana and Florida, respectively, were among the first people to reject the grants and say they would not implement. There are a number of other governors who've done the same thing, or such as Scott Walker in Wisconsin, such as Sam Brown back in Kansas. And more and more, these governors are saying they're going to either not implement at all or wait to see what the Supreme Court has to say before they pursue it any further. We view the healthcare exchange issue as the most important and significant way that a state can determine whether they are going to go along with Obamacare or whether they are going to push back. It's been cited in a number of court opinions along the way up to the Supreme Court as an aspect of, as a measure of whether the law is being implemented or not. We believe as such that it undercuts the case brought against the law, not just the one that's currently before the Supreme Court, but other potential ones that could pick at different aspects of it. And so because of that, we make an argument, a pragmatic argument, that it would actually be bad for the states, that they would waste money, and that the better thing to do is not just to not implement, but to send the money back, to tell the Fed that if they want to manage your marketplace, that they're going to have to do it themselves, and to reject this over-encroaching nationalization of the healthcare marketplace.
What is happening in our state? We were the first state to cause the governor, and I say we because the people of the state of Oklahoma caused the governor to reject the $54 million early innovator grant. We had the largest grant awarded to this state, and the citizens of this state pushed back and she had to listen. Once it was, the legislature was forced to read the contract, which was the grant. Right. They clearly tied it to the Affordable Care Act, and they had all just come off the campaign trail in late 2010, campaigning against Obamacare. So it was a clear conflict of their campaign promises. So they were caused to give it back, and Kansas followed suit in other states as well. What we're finding here in the state of Oklahoma, and maybe you're seeing this elsewhere, is that there's another entity within the state that can accept those grants. They become the state-designated entity, and they can, they're not appropriated agency. In our case, it's a public beneficiary trust. And they can solicit and receive federal grants, and they are very busy implementing the provisions of both the stimulus bill, which was the real health care reform bill, to move toward electronic health records, and the establishment of the exchange in the state of Oklahoma. And all they're trying to do is make sure that there's legal, the law is passed to create the governance of the exchange. So there's this behind the scenes activity going on by an entity, furious activity, while the state on the surface looks like it's rejecting Obamacare. There's still an entity in the state of Oklahoma that is tasked with the force of putting in the infrastructure. So I think Kansas has an LLC that's doing the similar thing, but in our case, it's trust. We're about ready to come to the bottom of the first half, and when we come back on the second side, I wanted to ask you about when you were talking about exchange's delivery mechanism that can end up with price controls. What we're seeing in Oklahoma is a reduction in the number of insurance companies that can actually work in Oklahoma. We're seeing a contraction in the number of insurance providers, and
dramatic
contraction in those who are available. And another way that competition is being eliminated is through the medical loss ratio requirement, which does affect the smaller insurance providers. That's the music indicating the end of the first half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. Our guest today is Ben Dominich and of the Heartland Institute, and we're going to be back after a brief break.
Do you need to promote your business on the Internet? The Truth in Focus Radio Network reaches listeners locally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all across the United States. The shift is on from traditional media to internet marketing. Stay on the cutting edge with your business. Advertise with us today. Email radio at truthinfocus.org. You heard the word, so will they. Email us at radio at truthinfocus.org.
Welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is your host, Amanda Teagarden, in studio with Don Wyatt.
I'm delighted to be here, and boy, do I enjoy Mason Williams and classical gas.
You can listen to that over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
Our guest today is Ben Dominich and of the Heartland Institute, and we're talking about health insurance exchanges. And their position, their stance at the Heartland Institute, is that it would be better for the states to not establish a state-based exchange for a variety of reasons. And we're in the middle of that discussion right now. And when we ended the first half, we were talking about, I was beginning to off ask Benjamin about medical loss ratios and the elimination of competition. What is your position on that, or what do you know about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the medical loss ratio is something that can be very dry when you discuss it, but essentially what it amounts to is a command from on high, from the federal government, and frankly, you know, there are also state governments that have done this as well, that insurers, when they essentially take money from you in order to pay for their for your premium, that only a certain amount of that money can go into the pocket of the insurer. And just to put this in perspective, because I think it's important to recognize what this is about, and we've just come through a week where you know, there was the obvious national prominence of the issue of the administration commanding believers and individuals across the country that they had to purchase something regardless of whether it violated their right to the free exercise of religion. What we're really talking about here is something central about the overreach of government, where government decides to tell you how much you can price the product that you sell and how much of that price is allowed to go into your own pocket, as opposed to going back into making the product better or into doing, you know, other things. Imagine that in the equivalent of a small business owner. If you were to come into a shop and say to the small business owner, you know, you're selling these things that you make, but you're taking too much of that money for yourself. You need to give that money back to the people who are buying it from. It's something that, from my perspective, is just anathema to the role of government and society. But setting that aside, when it comes to state marketplaces, what we've seen is that there are a number of we know within the state marketplaces, if you look at the level of competition that's there, it is simply inadequate. And the reason for that is government regulation.
And the trend is unmistakably towards less competition as well. Well, I mean, it's not a static inadequacy. It's a rapidly growing inadequacy.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, frankly, is that insurers are being squeezed. It's very difficult for them to stay open, to stay in business in an environment where they have. I mean, frankly, they already have. In terms of the amount of profit that they get from the products that they sell, it's already a much lower proposition than you might think, and certainly lower than other areas of the marketplace. But setting that aside, what this really is about is the fact that government overwhelmingly directs and purchases healthcare and purchases healthcare within the marketplace to a greater degree than any other entity. And because of that, you have Medicare and you have Medicaid, and you're going to have the taxpayer-subsidized exchange individuals underneath Obama's law. Within the marketplaces of the states, the reason that you see fewer insurers being able to stay in business, being able to keep their doors open, is because the government has essentially regulated them out of business. They are treating them like public utilities. And because of that, they're in a position now where in order to meet the various medical loss ratio demands from the government, they are going to have to be put into a position where they direct an enormous percentage of the money that they get from people who are paying premiums back into providing care, and they're essentially putting limits on the amount of profit that they can take from the products that they sell. From our perspective, this is something that is, you know, and I don't mean to be overly dire here, but the end result of Obamacare is to eliminate the private insurance market, to shift the entire process to essentially a government-run system, a public-run system, a system wherein government has complete control over what you pay and over what you get. And from our perspective, that's really their end goal, regardless of whether they admitted it or not. They can talk a lot about, you know, oh, you're still going to be buying a private product. But if you're buying a private product that is completely run at the behest of the government, where the government has the final say on everything that it can sell, everything that it has to cover, I mean, just keep in mind what happened just this past week. The president's solution to the kind of backlash that he got from acquiring coverage of abortion services, contraception, of sterilization, of abortifacients, the kind of pushback that he got resulted in him saying, well, that's okay, I'm just going to make the insurers provide it for free. Imagine if let's say that there's a problem in the economy and people can't afford to drive anymore. And across the country, government bureaucrats come into gas stations and say, here's the deal, you're going to give people gas for free because we told you so. That's the equivalent of what just happened. And yet, you know, when it comes from the perspective of Washington, people are branding it as a compromise position.
The gasoline analogy isn't even as sinister because people don't normally have consciences about that. That's not a faith-based issue in addition to the economic issue.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're completely correct. It's not as if our country was founded on the idea or was started by people who came here in order to have the right to buy and sell gasoline. The thing that I think is really unfortunate about the process that we've gone through here is people don't quite understand how much of their liberty is lost under this law. And that's something that I always try to stress whenever I come to the States, because I think it's something that legislators tend to be less mindful of. Again, you have that sort of the tyranny of do-goodism, where they say, well, what's the best for people? Guess what? Whenever we look at these things, big government, no matter whether it's bad or whether it's good, when you start it, always becomes bad government. And it becomes that in various speeds, but it always does. And the reason that we believe in America, in the idea that you ought to have a meritocracy of earned success, that you ought to be able to have a life that you make for yourself, is founded on the idea that individuals are in charge of their own lives and can direct their own paths. And frankly, that's not just because we think it's a better outcome for the people, but we believe that it's the principled approach to governance. And within the context of the States, I would just say this: you're seeing a path toward a situation where only the biggest insurers will be able to function, where they will be put into a constant strain, where they are having to abide by the whims of the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, no matter what they want to achieve. And when it comes time to sort of look at the bill at the end of the day, none of the steps that the president is taking is going, or that his administration have taken, is going to result in lower premiums for the American people. They promised again and again to cut the cost of the premiums for the average American by $2,500 a year, and yet they keep on going up and up and up, and they're going to continue to do so.
Yeah, they have to. I mean, it's apparent to a common sense driven person that they clearly have and will. Hey, could you? I know that there's so much here to cover, and we're going to run out of time, I'm afraid, before we've even scratched the surface pretty good. But could you help our listeners understand this federal government compromise, the quasi-federal state private public hub, all that kind of terminology?
Well, the word that I would use for it is nothing burger, which is. It is vaporware. It is not a real thing. Essentially, what is happening, just to give people some perspective, is that the anticipated results of Obama's law, from the perspective of the White House and the administration, have not actually happened. They expected that states would buckle. They expected that states would all implement. They expected that they would not have to create a federal exchange at all. They expected that they would not have to create anything in terms of entities at the federal level. They would have to handle the various burdens that are required under the law. Unfortunately, they found that, from their perspective, unfortunately, that the states actually have a little bit more steel in their spine than they expected. They have rejected, again and again, the attempts of the federal government to give an olive branch or to find some way to make these things work. And now the feds are stuck with a situation where they're expecting essentially to be in a situation where they're going to have to handle a lot more requests in terms of the people who they're going to have to support legally through their exchange than they ever expected. And one of the things that just sort of should give people an example of this is in the president's most recent budget request. Originally, they had budgeted a very small amount of money to allow the federal exchange to be set up. And they had originally allowed just for the creation of these kind of federal state partnerships, sort of vague exchange things. They'd never really codified what those would be, but it was something that could happen at the behest of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Under the president's most recent budget request, they had to request billions of dollars in additional funding for the creation of a federal exchange, because now they would have to, under the current approach, they would have to bear the costs of these 35 other states that haven't set up exchanges yet, and handle the people who are going through them. And this is just an enormous task for them. It's something that they never wanted to have to handle. Because of this, you can see sort of the box that they're put in. They're trying to come up with other solutions to get states to take this thing over and to take it off their hands. They are facing a nightmare in terms of the implementation of this law. And so because of that, they are sort of desperately throwing out, well, let's come up with a different model. You know, what works for you? We'll work with you. You don't want to be in a, you know, a legal position where we have to cut off things, and there are all sorts of threats that they've made, most of which are founded in nothing. But I think that in terms of what you're looking at right now, it's a federal government that is desperate to get the states to take this burden off of their hands. And I think that what you're going to see, unfortunately, from the Fed's perspective, is most of the states are happy to wait until Election Day and wait until the Supreme Court has ruled before they make any determinations about what to accept.
Benjamin, you are saying exactly what we were saying here. We were trying to tell the legislators, do not build it because the federal government can't.
Yeah,
unless
the slogan we used is, don't build it and they can't come.
Yeah, that's what we were saying.
because
they can't. Because this has not been done, and this infrastructure, this technology infrastructure, this $1 billion for this exchange hasn't been done, so the states had to work out the kinks. And if the states don't comply, they can't build it. I want to talk to you about, during the interim, there was a joint legislative committee that met 5 times to discuss the impact of the federal health law on Oklahoma. I spoke at the 3rd or 4th meeting. And the lady who preceded me was a representative named Krista Drobak from the National Governors Association. And she proceeded to show in her presentation, which a lot of the slides came from either Kaiser or Robert Wood Johnson, but she was there representing the National Governors Association. She said, I'm going to show you a slide, but I don't want you to get nervous about it. But what this is the Federal Exchange Hub. And it was a picture of their proposal of this quasi-federal. It was the state and federal hub. And what it is a logic model that showed all of the connections between right down from the Treasury Department down to the Social Security Administration, the Department of Homeland Security,
IRS.
The IRS, et cetera, and then
your bank, the states,
et cetera. And because consumers are over there kind of off to the left, but it's all this grid work. At the very bottom were where the qualified health care providers were.
Right.
In this special box were only mentioned Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, United Healthcare, and Aetna.
Right.
And the legislators who were watching that didn't quite catch what the wording was in those little boxes, but it was only 3 major insurance providers. I later found that diagram from a Blue Cross Blue Shield Association presentation for South Carolina.
That's right.
The Governors Association had picked up their diagram and was presenting it in the state of Oklahoma as the picture of the federal data hub.
But, of course, the young lady had only been with the National Governors Association for a few weeks. Prior to that, she was.
She worked for the Health and Human Services
exactly.
Department.
Exactly.
Well, this gets me back to the medical loss ratio question, because only the large insurance companies, the corporations like Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Healthcare, and Aetna, and probably Cigna and some other people, can actually financially afford to make the medical loss ratio of 80-20, 80% back onto the providing services or healthcare, and then 20% for them, because of the number of people that they insure. And the guaranteed market they're going to get if the individual mandate goes through, they'll get all those additional people.
Mm.
So the end of this is not a marketplace, free market, and competition among insurance providers. It's an elimination of competition of insurance providers.
It's single payer by another name.
You know, you're completely right. It's a sort of death race toward it. The thing that I think is important for people to understand is what you've just described there is the reason why you will continue to see some legislators make the case for implementation, including Republican legislators. And by that, I would just suggest that most of the people who are out there who are in favor of implementation, just take a look maybe at where their political donations come from, because I bet you will find that the vast majority of them have an enormous number of connections within the insurer community, particularly connections with either the Blues or the other insurers that you mentioned.
Or they might even be brokers themselves, maybe.
Exactly,
what do you think?
Yeah.
It's funny you mention that, because one of the major proponents of this is a freshman legislator who received $5,000 in campaign contributions from Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. And he was a freshman legislator running the exchange bill last session.
That's right.
And it's pretty heavy hitting for a freshman, but he did receive that very hefty boost from, just happens to have been, Blue Cross Blue Shield.
So here's the thing that I just want to point out about that. You know, I don't entirely begrudge the insurers for behaving like that. They're behaving logically in response to what the government has done. In other words,
that's a good point.
Defend their turf.
That's a good point.
But the point is, this is the inevitable result of the kind of cronyist approach to government that President Obama has typified and that has been accepted for far too long at all levels. You know, not just the federal level.
Well,
and I think that's an important thing to remember.
It's worse. It could be argued that that is inevitable once government gets involved. And you can go back to Republican and Democratic administrations alike, and the outcome's identical.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why, I always cite the examples, from Calvin Coolidge in terms of, the approach that he had to the government and to his rejection of the idea that you needed to have these sort of rent-seeking entities, and the acceptance of that. You know, the role of government, the meaning of freedom, ought to be that you as an individual spend more time working for yourself and less for the government. And the worst, the way that ends, the way that you end up spending more time working for government, is when these entities essentially become, public utilities or everything short of that, private in name only. And that's something that I think that we have to reject. We have to reject it at all levels, and not just within the healthcare space. But right now, one of the biggest areas where this is happening is within the healthcare space.
And it is being promoted in our state, at least, because there's a Republican majority in every chamber by Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's unfortunate. You're not alone in that. I will say that there are other Republican governors and legislators who I have argued with or testified before or made the case before to not implement. So you are not alone in that. But I would just say, again and again, what I see is that the people who are making that argument are becoming more and more desperate because they understand that the writing is on the wall, that this law is still incredibly unpopular, and frankly that there's so many problems with it that in the aftermath of the coming election, I expect that whether Republicans or Democrats win, the law is going to have to be reopened and either to fix it from the Democrat perspective or to essentially erase it from the Republican perspective.
It would be great to erase it.
I can't think of very many solutions, and that's the only one that comes to my mind. And we'd have to erase the bureaucracies that have been set up nationwide and at the federal level. As a result of that, we've got this residue all over the place. It's going to have to be eradicated.
The one thing that I would just urge people to keep in mind is that once the individual mandate is knocked down, and I do expect that the Supreme Court will knock it down, I wouldn't necessarily put a bet on it, but I would say that I do expect it. Keep in mind that is not the end of the law. Just because you have knocked out that strut from underneath it. If the Supreme Court does indeed find that portion of it is severable, we are still going to be in a significant fight after the November elections, regardless of what happens, in order to try to take this law away and take it off the books, erase it. And my approach is just as they say in Aliens, you got to nuke it for more of it. It's the only way to be sure.
We're about out of time, but I want to give you plenty of time to talk about what action steps do you recommend that states take? We're a grassroots group here, and we have a pretty good grassroots network across the state, so we're doing what we can to educate the legislators on what healthcare reform is actually about, and to identify the bills in the state that are the implementers or the enablers. But other than that, what other steps can states or people take in their states?
Well, one thing that I think everyone should be cognizant of is that there's, you know, as I said before, there's a lot of pressure from the insurers and from other entities that would stand to gain financially from the implementation of this law to move in that direction. The best way to offset that is just to be essentially a bug in the ear of the legislator that you have, the person that you elected, to remind them that you are paying attention to this, and that you're not about to let them implement and get away with it, that you're going to make yourself heard. You can obviously use the resources that Heartland.org has. I also think that there are a number of groups out there that are making significant activist strides. We are not an activist group, but you know, I certainly endorse the actions of groups like FreedomWorks, Americans for Prosperity has done some good things within these areas to make yourself heard in Washington. And I also endorse, you know, the approaches of your local Tea Party group and other groups that are standing strong on this and are not going to just accept the arguments that come down the pike. One thing that I would just sort of urge is, you know, a small number of people can really make themselves heard in a powerful way if they reach out to their legislator. And while a member of Congress or a senator might be able to ignore your wishes, legislators tend to be more attuned to that because they're a little bit more afraid of you. And the best way to make yourselves heard is to remind them that you're paying attention, to read up about these things, to understand them, to be able to respond to their arguments when they make them. Frankly, you know, I just think that that's something that we've seen happen in states across the country, and the result of that has been shifts in opinion. When Governor Bob McDonnell here in Virginia was prepared to implement an exchange, we reached out to the legislators in the state capitol, to his staff and to others. There were op-eds written, there were briefs filed, there were memos that were written, and the result of that was that he announced that he would not be implementing an exchange. I think that, frankly, people just need to make themselves heard on these points, and I have confidence that this law is unpopular. It's going to remain unpopular, and that the entire sort of mojo of in one direction or the other is in favor of repeal.
Hey, Ben, help me with one specific thing. Some of these tyrannical do-gooders that you talk about keep trying to argue that, well, the Heritage Foundation said that exchanges are a good idea. What's the best response you can suggest to us for that?
The best response that I would have is, you know, an exchange might not be a bad idea, but an exchange that is an Obamacare exchange includes redistributionist taxpayer subsidies, it includes price controls, it includes government regulation from Washington, it includes all sorts of other things. If we want to talk about an exchange in the aftermath of repeal of Obamacare, we'd be happy to have that conversation if we need one. But regardless of whether that's needed or not, it is not an acceptable role of government to implement something that is not just unconstitutional, but that is foolhardy and that restricts the liberties of their citizens. And that, I think, is the response that I would give. Heritage itself, approved the exchange model at a staff level, but they themselves have said, Ed Haselmeyer, who is their head of healthcare policy, has said that if states that currently under the rules that HHS has given out, there would be no difference for the state to implement an exchange versus the federal government to do so. They would have no more rights or abilities to direct what that would look like than if the federal government did it. So I would throw that back in their face, frankly, if that's something that's brought up.
I have one more question for you, if we've got time. Do we have time, Benjamin? Okay. What other word are you starting to... The legislators are on to the fact that the word exchange is a dirty word, and so they're very careful. We've made it toxic. So now what they're going to do in Oklahoma is try to implement an exchange but not call it an exchange, and you can't use marketplace in legislation. Is there another word or term or expression to...
Have you heard somebody else?
Something else, yeah. Have you heard any other words? Because we're going to be looking.
You know, that's a good question. I haven't heard one yet. I have heard various suggestions, such as, you know, if we don't implement an exchange, we'll lose all of our Medicaid funding come 2015 or something like that. We've heard suggestions that If you don't implement an exchange, that the federal government can cut off any money that you get from Washington. All sorts of ludicrous claims in that area designed to scare people. I have not actually heard another word used to describe it. But, you know, frankly, the one that I would use would be boondoggle, keeping in the terms of our fair host there. So.
That would be accurate.
I don't think
the legislators will use that. I'm thinking that they're going to use a flowery term, something like health patient decision aid or something
decision
like that.
Decision support system.
Decision support system. And, because they'll literally name it something that sounds good, and then inside...
Valet.
Insurance valet. There you go. I know it's not going to be marketplace. All right. Again, tell people how can they reach you if they wanted to, and the Heartland. And I failed to introduce you as a research fellow at the Heartland Institute and the managing editor of Healthcare News. So how can people read Healthcare News? Is that on heartland.org?
Yes, they can go to heartland.org, and they can just go to the health section if they want to find out more about what we're doing. They can also subscribe there to a weekly email update that I have called the Consumer Power Report. And you can also subscribe to a lot of other updates from our various news entities and not just our research fellows, but also people who do original reporting on things. We put out a number of original reports on issues, and then also, obviously, the policy briefs, things of that nature. I'd encourage people to go to heartland.org and to do that. And you can also email me at bdominich, that's B-D-O-M as in Mary, E-N as in Nancy, E-C-H at heartland.org. And I'm always happy to talk about these issues, and thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Benjamin, it's been a delight, and everything that we heard about your presentation was accurate. And you do a great job explaining it in terms and in a manner that people can grasp what the issue is. And very patient also while you're explaining it. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today. And this is Amanda Teagarden in studio with Don Wyatt. And we thank you for listening to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. And may God bless you.